This Thursday, October 25th, marks the anniversary of a bloody day here in the East Bay. On this day last year, thousands of police burst into the Occupy Oakland camp at Oscar Grant Plaza in the wee hours of the morning. Dozens of people were arrested, many were gassed, and that night thousands converged on downtown Oakland, where police again attacked peaceful protesters, hurling concussion grenades and gas canisters, badly injuring Iraq veteran against the war Scott Olson. This set off a chain of events that included some real high points in the Occupy movement nationally, including the so-called Oakland General Strike on November 2nd and the West Coast port shutdown on December 12th. Occupy has gone pretty quiet in recent months, but it's still rumbling around in the Bay. I'm now joined by two people who are still very active with Occupy Oakland. Laleh Behbahanian is well known as a member of Occupy Oakland's Anti-Repression Committee. She's also a doctoral candidate in sociology at the University of California, Berkeley, and the subject of a documentary that's recently surfaced on YouTube. Tori Becker is a member of La Gay Queer Insurrection, of which I'm also a member. Tori is a longtime labor and lesbian activist. She was on the executive board of SEIU Local 616 and Vote Health, a co-founder of Direct Action for Single Payer. She's a member of Old Lesbians Organizing for Change and an active participant in Oakland Occupy Patriarchy and the Dignity and Resistance Coalition. Laleh, what do you feel were the biggest accomplishments of the Occupy movement in general and Occupy Oakland in particular?
I think that a lot of people tend to think of Occupy almost exclusively in relation to camps. And so there's this sense that, you know, the camp is gone, particularly in the case of, you know, Occupy Oakland, that the camp is no longer there. And so, you know, Occupy is dead and things aren't happening. And mainstream media is kind of, encourage that view by not really covering all of the things that are going on. And so people know about the general strike and some of the bigger actions early on. But, you know, as soon as it really became increasingly dangerous and unfeasible to continue to occupy the plaza, the camp, there was almost a metamorphosis of Occupy. We came to the realization that if we're not able to occupy in these public spaces like these plazas as a result of enormous amounts of police violence and repression, then what we'll do is we'll just occupy all over our communities. And so what's been happening is all kinds of foreclosure defense actions, which have been a really strong part of Occupy Oakland, all kinds of labor solidarity actions. You know, a lot of people know of the work with the longshoremen, but there's also been a lot of solidarity work done with, for example, the Red Vine licorice workers or the Castlewood workers who had been locked out of their jobs for 2 years and recently had a victory in their case. You know, there's been all kinds of work that continues to be done. It doesn't get much coverage. And what does get a lot of coverage is, you know, kind of sensationalized reporting about raids on marches and kind of fear mongering around anarchists and black blockists. But, you know, really no coverage of all of the homes in West Oakland, East Oakland, throughout the Bay Area that have been defended by people. There's been a lot of work done to defend schools that are being shut down. There's five public schools that are being shut down in the city of Oakland. And there's been a huge effort around kind of defending Lakeview Elementary, one of them. There's been work done in what's been called Occupy the Farm, right? You know, so land that's held by UC Berkeley that's attempting to kind of turn it into another cash cow through kind of privatization and a defense of that space by the community. And people continue to harvest and grow. And so I think our accomplishments are actually much broader than most people would ever even imagine.
How did you get involved? Were you an activist before Occupy?
I was. Like, I think many people at whatever level, whether or not they considered themselves to be kind of, you know, organizers in that sense. Yes, I, you know, was involved in a lot of the struggles in the university system, in the UC system, which we've been dealing with all kinds of labor struggles there, struggles against privatization, budget cuts, and just generally the way as a public, you know, institution, it's being slowly, you know, pulled away from the people. So, you know, I've done work with Students for Justice in Palestine and around various issues. But I have to say that, you know, through all those years, there's really, I've never had an experience like the past year with Occupy, and I have never seen the kind of possibilities that I've seen.
And Tori, like me, you've been a radical activist for most of your life, and you were enthralled by the Occupy decolonized movement, as was I. What do you feel were the best things about the Occupy movement and Occupy Oakland?
I think one of the most wonderful things about Occupy in general was it captured the imagination of so many people, and it connected to a worldwide upsurge of people who were upset with what was going on in their lives. And it's, you know, in Egypt and all over the world this happened, and Occupy was part of that. In Oakland, what was particularly wonderful was the combination of old leftists, young leftists, young anarchists, community people, people who lived on the street, people with mental illness, all live together in an encampment and try to make a decision-making process with the GAs. I thought that was absolutely wonderful, that this attempt to do this went on. I used to work as a nurse in a clinic, and I would run into people who had been my patients, and they would say, "Oh, Tori, you're marching with us." That was wonderful. Another wonderful thing was the really huge marches, the two marches to shut down the port. The first one, which was one of the most wonderful demonstrations I'd ever been on, just because it was massive, it was huge, and everybody was there. The second shutting down of the port was wonderful also, though it wasn't as big, but it was wonderful because it was a coordinated day all up and down the West Coast of shutting down ports.
As a labor activist, how did you see some people have said, oh, this is the first movement ever where leftists and students and labor activists work together, which I think is not true. And others have said that the movement was not respectful of labor and didn't reach out to labor, didn't manage to incorporate labor the way that it should have. You know, you have long-standing ties to the labor movement. How did you feel about that?
Well, I think there's a considerable ambivalence on the part of this movement about labor. Many, particularly the younger people, were not very young people who were involved in it, had never been in unions, but saw themselves as having an extremely difficult time getting jobs, having a real job, being able to make money to take care of themselves, and saw the unions as in some way selling out. On the other hand, the unions, in the beginning of the movement, the unions were very much part of things, particularly on the first big port shutdown day. As things became more splintered as time went on, it felt more like the unions drew, in Oakland particularly, that the unions went sort of separated out and were became seen more as part of the liberal left as opposed to the real revolutionary part of the movement.
And Lale, what do you feel might have been done differently?
Well, there's a couple things. One, I have to say that in a way this is my opinion. I think there's a lot of debate on this within Occupy Oakland and generally within Occupy. But I think that we need to improve in a sense in our kind of public relations battle. And I say that this isn't a position held by everybody, because some people think that, you know, well, it really doesn't matter what kind of image is presented in the media. We should just continue doing our work. You know, there's others that feel that really there's no way to intervene in a kind of corporate mainstream press. And so it's a failing battle. So why even engage? But I think that, you know, the state's capacity to do violence is always based on a certain level of consent from the public. And, you know, we saw, you know, after the raids in Oakland on October 26, we saw that the public did not consent to that kind of violence. And the city of Oakland saw it, and the, you know, OPD saw it. And what I think we've seen happen over the course of the year is a kind of development, a sophistication in their forms of repression, And it's involved all kinds of things, but in particular, it's involved essentially a mass media campaign to demonize occupiers. And so, you know, we saw that just, you know, 10 days ago, right? On October 6th, it was a weekend of actions around Columbus Day and, you know, kind of protesting various forms of colonialism, capitalism. It was the anniversary of the, you know, 11-year anniversary of the war in Iraq. And so there was a whole weekend
Afghanistan.
So there was a whole weekend of actions planned. And that Saturday, there was a march in San Francisco, which was attacked by the police within just a couple of blocks of beginning. And the justification for the police attack was that, you know, there was something thrown by protesters and there was some minor injury, which at this point we think is paint that was thrown at a police officer. But basically, you know, San Francisco police attack this crowd of protesters, you know, kind of hurling their batons and kettling in people. And ultimately, you know, arrested 22 people, viciously beat many people in the process, and, you know, cited and released two of them. One had charges dropped eventually because of, you know, his father came and posted bail and threatened to sue the city. But for the 19 other people, they were all jailed. They were all charged with felony conspiracy, as well as a whole range of other felonies, felony assault, etc. And held in jail for days up until, you know, a week. And during that time, and this is another example of, you know, kind of mainstream media's role, the Chronicle posted their, you know, mug shots, and, you know, the SFPD was kind of distributing all this information with claims of, essentially making claims that the conspiracy charges were based upon connecting these people to a march earlier in the end of September in the Mission. And that on the basis of the fact that there were masks worn and there were certain items like, you know, spray paint, et cetera, that was the basis of claiming that this was what the spokesperson for SFPD said was a criminal gang, a criminal street gang. And there was all kinds of kind of fear-mongering allegations about black blockists and, you know, anarchists. And we're increasingly seeing that word used. We're seeing this kind of revival of the use of the word anarchist as a slur. It basically, what was presented to the public was this image of these occupiers who are violent and kind of bent on destruction. And ultimately, once we get to court, after they sit in jail for days, those conspiracy charges fall apart, and the DA can't really actually charge any of them with anything except misdemeanors, a whole bunch of misdemeanors like obstruction or, you know, a misdemeanor for wearing a mask. And of course, the Chronicle doesn't go back the week later after they've, you know, spent all this energy posting people's pictures and claiming they're part of a criminal street gang to go back and say, actually, these people were just arraigned on petty misdemeanors after spending days in jail and being beaten viciously. And I think that kind of really strong media campaign has started to have an impact. And there's an increasing kind of, I think, decline in support for Occupy as a result. So one thing I think that we need to do is we need to take seriously that we really have to disrupt the consent right now that's being given to the state for both the violence that the police are doing, but also the violence that the legal system is doing through these forms of prosecution.
You know, I was actually on that march on Saturday in San Francisco a couple weeks ago, and I went away from the main group to see what was happening. A small group had taken off, and I went to see what had happened to them, and they had been arrested up a few blocks away on Pine Street, and there weren't that many people there. It seemed like the police were using quite a bit of violence against them. So I asked one of the cops, what are they being charged with? And he said, resisting arrest. And I always think it's hilarious when they tell me that someone's being arrested for resisting arrest.
Right. We've had hundreds and hundreds of people charged in Occupy Oakland for obstruction and nothing else. And so that's another example of hundreds of people arrested for obstructing, and it's unclear, you know, what's the original thing that they were obstructing.
Then I sort of made a face, and he said, well, I think it was refusing to obey a dispersal order or something. So clearly they did not have at that point any idea about these people being in a conspiracy. But then by the time they got to jail, they were, instead of being cited and released, as normally happens, they were charged with these conspiracy charges. And I was very surprised by that, because my understanding was that the Lawyers Guild had an agreement with the San Francisco police or the DA's about not using conspiracy charges to hold demonstrators in jail, stemming from the Democratic Convention, when that was in 1984, when people were surrounded and charged with conspiracy to block the sidewalk with the goal of holding us in jail throughout the convention. And there was a lawsuit because of a lot of the things that happened around the convention. And one of the terms of that settlement, I understood, was that they would not use those conspiracy charges. So I was very surprised to see these cropping up again, in part because, I mean, I kind of imagined that with the encampments gone and the Occupy movement pretty much off the media radar, that the state's interest in repressing it might have waned. But if anything, it seems to have escalated. And to what do you attribute this escalation on attacks on Occupy and other street activists?
I think that initially what was believed was that if you could clear people from these public spaces, if you could make it unfeasible for people to actually be able to claim public spaces in the middle of their cities and towns, that Occupy would just wither away. And even when it became impossible for us to remain in the plaza in Oakland, what happened was those efforts then just spiraled out into the community. And so, you know, what happened was people continued to defend, you know, foreclosed homes and continue to occupy schools being shut down and, you know, harvest and grow on land being privatized and, you know, continue to build public libraries in the middle of East Oakland, you know, where the city has abandoned them. These things have continued. And so the repression had to change, right? Because when what the state is dealing with is these groups of people in a public space, you can come in with tear gas, you can come in with these forms of brute violence. When the response of the movement has then been to undertake this kind of, you know, really kind of diversified forms of action in all these different places, the state has had to change. It's, you know, it's had to adapt in terms of its repression. And I think what we've seen is a few things. One is that there's been, I think what people don't realize is the greatest violence has been done to occupiers, not by those in police uniforms, but by those in suits that walk in and out of the courtrooms of San Francisco and Oakland and all over this country every day through the forms of prosecution that are going on. So one kind of strategy has been to start targeting individuals, right? People who are particularly active, and getting people caught up in a long kind of legal battles around prosecution. And I think the other adaption has been this, as I've been talking about, this media campaign, right, of demonizing Occupy. The thing is, if Occupy is dead, then why so much effort to continue to try and kill us, right? You know, I think that what we're seeing is an adaption of the forms of repression that are very much in line with what has been done in Oakland for a long time, right? Oakland is quite used to going after gang injunctions and treating all kinds of people as being part of criminal street gangs. So,
yeah, I mean, especially because they did use some of the same tactics that are being used against so-called gang members, like stay away orders, ordering people to stay away from public places like City Hall, you know. How many cases, as far as you know, how many people have been arrested over the last year, and how many of them have actually been charged?
There have been, at this point, almost 850 arrests in this 1 year of Occupy Oaklanders. And of those, no more than around 10% were ever charged. But the vast majority of those people did spend 1, 2, 3, 4 nights in jail, before then being released with no charge. So, I mean, we've really done thousands of hours of jail time with no charges. So we have that, you know, 90% of people that were charged and were arrested and not charged, which in my mind, you know, if you make an arrest once or twice that turns out to be an error, it's one thing. When you've made over 700 arrests that were mistakes within a year around, a particular protest movement, then clearly it's actually, you know, an intended form of repression to frighten people and to kind of wear away at the movement. Of those that have been, you know, have been actually charged, many, many of those people were actually in the end, they were charged with minor misdemeanors like obstruction, which has been one of the most common in Oakland, in Alameda County. Obstruction of a police officer is one of the few misdemeanors that you can actually hold somebody in jail for until arraignment, as opposed to citing and releasing them. You know, there's many people that have been pulled through the legal system now for months and months and months in what could only be called malicious prosecution, being really ridiculously, disproportionately, harshly prosecuted for really, really minor misdemeanors. And then there are, you know, a number of cases of people who are actually being much more viciously prosecuted. One particular situation, which I think echoes in many communities, is, of course, all of the people who have been the most brutally beaten by OPD. And now on October 6th, by, you know, in the case of SFPD as well, the result, of course, is that, you know, the police can't beat you without then charging you with something, right? It's been a great deal of repression that has been, you know, doled out through the legal system of Oakland.
And has anyone actually been convicted of any of these charges?
We've had a conviction on obstruction of a public thoroughway, and we've had a conviction that is now being appealed on a case of a breaking of a bank window. And so, you know, most of the cases have not come to any conclusion. And are being kind of pulled along. And I got to say, many of the cases, the DA's office is attempting to plead them out, which, of course, is bitter to many people who, you know, were actually targeted by the police and now have spent a year trying to defend themselves and taking off work countless times, getting babysitters just to appear in court again and again and again. And so, it's hard for somebody to then take a plea deal, even if it's so minor.
You're listening to Women's Magazine on KPFA 94.1 FM and online at kpfa.org. I'm Kate Raphael, and I'm talking about Occupy Oakland with Lale Behbahanian of the Occupy Oakland Anti-Repression Committee and Tori Becker of Oakland Occupy Patriarchy and the Dignity and Resistance Coalition. Some people, and I admit to being one of them, perceived Occupy Oakland as very male-dominated. And some have argued that it was mostly white. Others have said, no, it was people of color led, and women and queer people were equally empowered in this movement. What has been both of your experience with that?
I would say that the criticism that Occupy Oakland was male dominated is true. I also think that there was a large control on the part of young white male activists. That being said, a number of things happened trying to deal with the problems of race and gender and class, one of which was Oakland Occupy Patriarchy. Part of why I went to Occupy Patriarchy was I was looking for a way to connect to Occupy Oakland and found it difficult in the broader movement because it was so male dominated. Occupy Patriarchy was an attempt to make a place for feminists, queers, trans people, gay people to organize and be part of the larger movement.
The forms of inequality and oppression that shape our entire world are present in Occupy and in Occupy Oakland. And we cannot deny it, and it shouldn't be surprising. That's the reality. And we struggle with those things, but absolutely, you know, and not only gender, race, class, nationality, sexuality, all of these things, you know, as much work as we do, I think we end up doing just as much working on our relationships and those issues amongst ourselves. So, you know, it's absolutely there. And it's something that I know frustrates many women, you know, it frustrates many people of color, et cetera, within the movement. I think that it's important that we deal with it, not only because that's the world we're trying to create, but precisely because those things are what get used and get manipulated actually in order to repress us. For example, you know, this new kind of image that we're getting of this outsider, white, anarchist, black bloc, et cetera, is, you know, the state playing on those racial divisions within the movement. And the state is able to do that because, in fact, those divisions are real. And so we have to work on these issues amongst each other, because if we don't, they are like open wounds just ready to be kind of poked by the state.
Are people dealing with those issues in a serious way?
I think that that people have always been trying to do that work. I think that the enormity of that work is beyond words. And it's work that, you know, it's not just the work of the movement when you go out and organize and talk to people and, you know, flyer or plant things or, you know, defend homes. It's a really kind of personal, emotional, hard work between people that you struggle with. And it can hurt, and it can leave bitterness, and it can leave resentment. And those things are really real. And after a year of working together and taking risks together and people putting their, you know, essentially their lives on the line with each other, you know, those wounds and those hurts, they have enormous kind of potential to completely overtake a movement, right? And what I see right now are, you know, a lot of forms of bitterness and feuds and fighting that happen in all social movements, any that I've studied, right? That's always been the case. And the thing we know is that that's all, you know, when that really starts to take shape, you know that there's a real kind of campaign of repression there. And I have no doubt that a lot of this is being kind of poked by an actual intentional campaign by the state. But the fact is that we are all, you know, many of us get pulled into it at times because of those very real wounds.
And Tori, I know you've been involved in Decolonize Oakland somewhat, and you would have liked to see Occupy change its name to Decolonize, but you stayed involved in Occupy. I read a blog post the other day from a woman who said that in retrospect, she saw the decision not to change the name as the beginning of the end for Occupy Oakland. What's your response to that?
I, in some ways, agree with that. I think that was the point at which it became clear that things were going to fracture, that there were many issues that people weren't being able to deal with, that the issues of race were not being addressed, the issues of sexism and classism, all those things, that people didn't have the will to address them in the context of the GAs. So in that sense, I do think that that's a true statement. I also think that that it's possible that had the decolonized people decided to stay, the same kind of fractures would have occurred in some other way. I'm not a part of Decolonize Oakland because Decolonize Oakland is specifically a people of color and queer people of color organization. But I support them, and I support what they were trying to do when they left Occupy Oakland. I have had some experience being in coalition with them. The Dignity and Resistance Coalition was a coalition that formed to create the May Day, a broad-based worker immigrant rights May Day march, and it included Decolonize Oakland and people from Occupy Oakland and other people, myself included, to make that march. This coalition, which is an excellent coalition, continues and is now working on another struggle, support for the Mi Pueblo Mercado grocery store workers who are being harassed by the management there.
And since you brought up the Mi Pueblo campaign, why don't you tell us a little about what that's about?
Mi Pueblo is a chain of grocery stores that serves Latino communities all over many parts of California. They're out in Central Valley, San Jose, Oakland, Palo Alto, many places. The man who owns it was formerly undocumented himself. He became a multimillionaire, and now In the last 2 years, workers in the stores have been trying to organize and be part of a union. UFCW, United Food and Commercial Workers Union, is involved. As a result of the workers trying to organize, the owner of the store has retaliated by voluntarily, he doesn't have to do this, asking for E-Verify to come in and check people's papers to see if they're documented or undocumented. It's gotten even more complicated than that, because as a result of asking for E-Verify, the federal government has come in and started doing I-9 audits looking at people's status. We've heard workers talk about some of the conditions. There's health and safety issues. People are fired at will. So the Dignity and Resistance Coalition decided to reconstitute itself, and we had a picket at the Oakland store in support of the Mi Pueblo workers last Saturday the 20th, and we're going to continue to do an ongoing campaign in support of the workers. I saw a statistic that perhaps 80% of the people working at the Mi Pueblo stores are undocumented. I heard several workers talk about how frightening it was to have that, the fact that they could be deported, hanging over their heads. It's just an incredibly vulnerable situation on a job. Still, the workers are organizing and standing up for their rights in spite of how vulnerable they feel.
So, do you feel like, you know, as somebody who's been, you know, you were already active in a lot of the issues that Occupy took on, healthcare, housing for poor people, prison issues. Do you feel that Occupy has changed the political landscape in the Bay Area, or is it just another movement that was big for a little while?
I actually think it's changed the political landscape in spite of all the many difficulties. There's been a sort of a reinvigoration of activism, and it just all kinds of things. There's Chalkupy, there's Aquapy, the People's Library, there was the Lakeview sit-in. There's a new interest in claiming space and taking places for people. That's happened before, but I feel like Occupy has made that be a bigger thought in people's minds, is how do we take places and make community.
I spoke to Tori Becker of Oakland Occupy Patriarchy and La Gay Queer Insurrection, and Lale Behpahanian of Occupy Oakland's Anti-Repression Committee. You can find the documentary about Lale on the Occupy Oakland webpage, occupyoakland.org, and you can also check there for information about actions on Thursday and beyond. For information on the Mi Pueblo boycott, see ufcw5.org. You're listening to Women's Magazine here on listener-sponsored KPFA 94.1 FM and online at kpfa.org. Our blog is kpfawomensmag.blogspot.com, and you can find archived segments from past shows there, as well as information about all of our guests. You can email us at kpfawomensmag@gmail.com. I'm Kate Raphael. We'll be back in just a minute.
The Democrats won in 08, but I still ain't satisfied, 'cause we still got a corporate state. I still ain't satisfied. It's not the party of the hour, it's the Wall Street gang that's got the power. And I still ain't, whoa, they lied. I still ain't, whoa, they lied. I still ain't, whoa, they lied. I still ain't satisfied. We're working hard to fight cutbacks, but I still ain't satisfied. Until Wells Fargo pays their tax, I still ain't satisfied. So we tax the banks and the very wealthy. Our safety net could still be healthy. And I still ain't, whoa, they lied. I still ain't, whoa, they lied. I still ain't, whoa, they lied. I still ain't satisfied. We saw an inconvenient truth, but I still ain't satisfied. 'Cause carbon's going through the roof, I still ain't satisfied. When lobbies buy our power,
politicians. We cannot stop toxic emissions. And I still ain't, whoa, they lie.